Joseph stood there and tried his heart upon the voluptuously smiling majesty of that endurance. He stood quite close. Would not the monster lift its paw from the sand and snatch the youth to its breast? He armed his heart and thought of Jacob. Curiosity is a shallow-rooted weed. It is but youth triumphing in freedom. Eye to eye with the forbidden, one knows the sonhood of the Spirit and holds with the Father. Joseph stood long under the stars before the giant riddle, leaning on one leg, his elbow in one hand, his chin in the other. When he lay again with Kedema in the hut, he dreamed of the Sphinx, that it said to him, "I love thee. Come to me and name me thy name, of whatever sex I am." But he answered, "How shall I commit such a deed and sin against God?" The House of the Swaddled One. They had gone along the western bank, the one on their right as they faced south, and the right one in any case, for they needed not to cross over to reach Mempi the Great, which itself lay in the west, the hugest sheepfold of men that Rachel's firstborn had ever seen. Above it towered the heights where stone was quarried and where the city buried its dead. Bewilderingly ancient was Mempi, and venerable in so far as the two ideas coincide. Mani, the first king, he who stood at the beginning of all memories and dynasties, had fortified the city to keep out the subjugated lower land. The mighty dwelling of Ptah, built out of eternal stone, was Mani's work. Accordingly, it had stood here much longer than the pyramids, had stood here since days behind which no man could look. But there was no rigidity nor torpor here. The primitive and ancient presented itself in Mempi's image as a scene of bustling life and alert modernity, a city of more than 100,000 souls, and composed, in its great extent, of many variously named quarters, a confusion of narrow, winding streets going uphill and down, all sloping toward their centers, where waste water ran in a drain. They reeked and seethed with trade and traffic, and hordes of grubbing and garrulous little men. There were the smiling quarters of the rich, where villas with beautiful gates lay enclosed in lovely gardens. There were green temple precincts, where pennants fluttered, and halls bright with delicate color were mirrored in sacred pools. There were Sphinx avenues 50 ells broad, and tree-bordered drives on which the wagons of the great rolled along, drawn by fiery steeds crowned with bunches of feathers. They were heralded by panting runners who cried out, "Abrek, take thy heart to thyself, take care." Yes, Abrek, Joseph too might well say it to himself, and take heed to his heart, so as not to fall victim to idle admiration before all that elegance and distinction. For this was Mempi, or Menphe, as the people said here, pertly abbreviating the name from Mennefru Mire, which signified "the beauty of Mire abides." Mire was a king of the 6th dynasty, who in his time had extended the temple fortress about his royal quarters and built close by the pyramid wherein his beauty was to abide. It had actually been the tomb that had been called Mennefru Mire, but the whole city overlapping had taken over the name of the burial place. Menphe, the balance of the lands, the royal city of the dead. How strange it was that the name Menphe was an impertinent abbreviation for a place of tombs. The idea occupied Joseph's mind a good deal. It was these little people thronging the narrow streets, with the gutters in the middle, who had run it all together like that, these lean-ribbed dwellers in the crowded poorer quarters of the town. In one such quarter was the caravanserai where the Ishmaelites lodged. It was crammed with strange specimens of the human race, Syrian, Libyan, Nubian, Mitannic, and even Cretan. Its dirty brick court was full of the bleating of animals and the squealing and whining of blind beggars playing on musical instruments. If Joseph issued forth, the street scene was like that in the cities of the homeland as well, only Egyptian and much magnified. On either side of the gutter, Barbers were shaving their customers, and cobblers pulling straps with their teeth. Potters turned their whirling vessels and shaped them with practiced and earthy hands, singing the while songs to Khnum, the creator, goat-headed lord of the wheel. Coffin-makers planed coffins in human shape with chin-beards. Drunken men staggered out of noisy pot-houses and were jeered at and mocked by little boys whose youth-locks still hung over their ears. What hordes of people! They all wore the same linen apron and the same haircut, had the same square shoulders and thin arms, and lifted their brows in one and the same naive and unabashed way. They looked quite capable of shortening the pomp and circumstance of death into the brisk and sprightly Menphe. Joseph, when he heard it, recalled the feelings that possessed him when once from his hilltop home he looked down on Hebron, the burial place of his ancestors. And piety, whose source is death, had mingled in his heart with the appeal made by the sight of the bustling town. A complex and delightful mixture, and one peculiarly his own. He felt its mysterious fitness in the light of the double blessing whose child he was, and also in the light of the jesting spirit which might be regarded as the link and messenger between them. To this latter, then, corresponded the popular name for the city of the dead, as a message from the jesting spirit. He felt his heart warm toward its inventors, those lean-ribbed little people along the gutters. He wanted to joke with them in their own tongue, to laugh and lift his eyebrows with their unconcern. That would not be hard. Likewise, he saw with sympathy that their love of the jest did not come from numbers alone, nor did it direct itself entirely outwards. The people of Menthe were making fun of themselves when they laughed about what their city once had been and was no longer, and their joke was an expression of the same sullenness which Joseph had felt in Per Sopt when he listened to the bitter carping of the temple priests. It was the mood of the outmoded and the superseded. But here it turned into a mockery which misdoubted all the world, including itself. For the fact was, Menphe, the balance of the lands, thick-walled, had been the royal city at the time of the pyramid builders. Menphe had been world-famous for endless years, and Thebes, in the upper southlands, had not been known at all. But after the accursed epoch of confusion and foreign domination, it was from Thebes that liberation came, and reunion under the now ruling dynasty of the sun. It was Wayse that now wore the double crown and bore the scepter, while Menphe, though bursting with population and no smaller than before, was a former queen, the grave of her own greatness, a capital whose name was an impudently abbreviated name of death. Not that Ptah, in his chapel, was a god rejected and impoverished, like Sopt in the east. No, great was his name among the regions, and rich in foundations, lands, and cattle was the god in human shape. So much was plain from the treasuries, granaries, stalls, and hayricks included in the complex of his temples. The Lord Ptah was seen of no one, for even when he made a progress in his bark, and visited one or other local divinity, his little image was hidden behind golden curtains, and only the priests who performed his service knew his face. He dwelt in his house, together with his wife, called Sakmet, or the Mighty, who was depicted lion-headed on the temple walls, and who was said to love war, and their son Nefertem, whose name signified the Beautiful, but who was even more obscure than Ptah, the human-formed, and Sakmet the Grim. He was the sun. More one knew not. Nor did Joseph learn more by questioning than this, that Nefertem the sun wore a lotus blossom on his head. It was even asserted that he himself was nothing else than a blue water lily. This vagueness, however, did not prevent the sun from being the most popular person of the triad of Menphe. Since all that was certain about him was his preference for the sky-blue lotus, that became the essence of his being, and thus his dwelling was always richly adorned with bunches of that beautiful flower. The Ishmaelites did not hesitate to honor his popularity, in the way of trade, by bringing him offerings of the blue lotus. Never had Joseph been so much among forbidden things as here. Those things to which his tradition referred when it said, thou shalt make to thyself no graven image. For Ptah was the god who created works of art, the protector of masons and craftsmen, of whom it was said that the plans of his heart were realized and his thoughts carried out. Ptah's great dwelling was nothing but pictures, full of images his house and the courts thereof, hewn out of the hardest, or out of lime and sandstone, wood and copper. The thoughts of Ptah peopled his halls, columns thick with shining scenes, resting on bases like millstones, elephant-like and crowned with capitals like bundles of reeds, rose up to the gold-dusted beams. Statues were everywhere, standing, sitting, striding, embraced on thrones with their diminutive children. Single images of kings, with cap-like crowns and crooked staves, the pleated frontpiece of their kilts spread out on their laps, headcloths with wings falling on the shoulders, on the front of which their ears stood out. These broad-shouldered, narrow-hipped lords of the earth had tender breasts. Their hands lay flat on their thighs. Their mien was high and grave, and their muscular upper arms were held by the clumsy little fingers of a tutelary goddess, while a falcon spread its wings in the nape of their necks. King Mire, who had made the city great, paced on his staff, a figure in copper, with his disproportionately small son at his side. He was fleshy of nose and lips, and, like the other images, was reluctant to lift from the ground the sole of his rear foot, but trod on both soles, standing in his walk and walking in his stance. They trod on sturdy legs, with heads erect, away from the stone pilasters at the back of their pedestals, and let their arms hang down from their square shoulders. In their clenched fists they held short, cylindrical pegs, or they were represented as scribes, legs tucked under them, hands busy with the work spread out in their laps, looking out over it with shrewd eyes. Sometimes there was a man and wife, sitting beside each other with knees together, with their skin, hair, and garments painted in the most natural colors, so that they were like the living dead. Often Ptah's artists had made them eyes to frighten the beholder, not out of the material of their faces, but separately put in. A little black stone set in vitreous paste, with a little silver peg inside that, which caught the light and glittered until one felt impelled to escape that flashing gaze and hid one's face in one's hands. Such were the thoughts of Ptah. Forever fixed and rigid, they dwelt there in his house, along with him, the lion mother, and the lotus son. He himself appeared in his human shape 100 times over in his chapel shrine, not an inch on whose walls but was covered with the magic of art. Yes, certainly in human shape, yet oddly doll-like, and, as it were, in abstract form, a side view with one leg and one long eye, his head covered with a close-fitting cap, on his chin the artificially attached wedge of the kingly beard. His whole figure was curiously undeveloped, sketched in outline, as were his fists, which held the staff of power before him. He seemed to be sheathed in a close, formless upper garment, or rather, quite frankly, he looked swaddled and embalmed. What was it about the Lord Ptah? How did it stand with him? Did the ancient great city deserve its name, not only on account of the pyramids after which it was called, and not only because its glory was of the past, but further and finally, even solely, as the house of the Lord Ptah? Joseph had understood whither he was bound when his purchasers led him down into Egypt, the land of Jacob's misprision. He had fully recognized that in consequence of his own estate he belonged thither, and that the forbidden was not forbid to him, but even oddly appropriate. Indeed, had he not betimes given himself a name which should characterize him as native-born? And yet he had constantly felt a grudge against his new surroundings, in the sense of his father, and always he itched to try the children of the land with questions about their gods and about the land of Egypt itself, that they might betray it to him who knew, and also themselves, when they seemed not to know it rightly. So was it with Master Baker Bata of Menphe, whom they met at the Apis sacrifice in the temple of Ptah. For besides the formless one, the lioness, the obscure sun, and the concrete thoughts of Ptah, there abode in the temple Hapi, the great bull, the repeating birth of the Lord, begot by a light ray from the sky upon a cow which afterwards never bore again. And his testicles dangled as massive as those of Merwer at On. He lived behind bronze doors at the back of a roofless, columned hall, where wainscotings filled with magnificent stonework ran between the pillars and fine mouldings at half their height. A dense crowd thronged the flag-paven court when Hapi was brought forward by his servants some paces out of the lamp-lit twilight of his chapel stall, that the people might see that the god lived and bring him offerings. Joseph, with his owners, witnessed one such ceremony. It was an extraordinary abomination, and an amusing one as well, thanks to the good nature of the folk of Menfe, men and women and sprawling children. They were excited by the festival and their expectation of the god, chattered and laughed, kissed, as they said, for 8 sycamore figs and onions. Water dripped from the corners of their mouths from the watermelon slices they ate, and they chaffered with the hucksters who lined the court, selling consecrated bread, sacrificial fowl, frankincense, honey, and flowers. A fat-bellied man in bast sandals stood next the Ishmaelites, and as the crowd squeezed them together, they spoke with each other. He wore a knee-length apron skirt of coarse linen with a three-cornered turnover. About his arms and rump he had wound all sorts of ribbons, in which he tied knots with pious intent. His hair lay short and smooth on his round pate. He had a good-natured face, and his glassy, protruding eyeballs protruded still more when his well-formed, shaven mouth moved as he talked. He measured the old man and his company from one side for a long time, before he addressed them and questioned them, curious of their strangeness, whence they came and whither they went. He himself was a baker, he explained. That is, he did not bake with his own hands, and stuck not his head in the oven, but employed half a dozen journeymen and distributors who carried his excellent rolls and crescents in baskets on their heads through the city. Woe to these if they did not take pains to wave their arms above their wares, so that the birds of the air did not pounce down and steal out of the basket. The bread carrier to whom this happened got a lesson, as Master Baker Bata expressed himself. That was his name. Also he possessed some ground outside the city, where he grew the corn he baked. But it was not enough, for his business was considerable, and he had to buy as well. Today he had come out to see the god, which was profitable in so far that it was not profitable to omit it. His wife, meanwhile, was visiting the great mother in the Eset house, and taking her flowers, being especially affected to that goddess, while he, Bata, got more satisfaction from coming here. "And as for them," the baker asked, "they were visiting the country for their business interests?" "That was it," the old man responded. "And they were, so to speak, at their goal, in that they were at Menfe, mighty in gates, rich in dwellings and enduring monuments, and might just as well now turn around again." "Thanks very much," said the master baker. They could, but probably they would not. For, like everybody else, they would more likely regard this old hole as a stage where to set their feet that they might pass on to the splendors of Amun. They would be the first to do otherwise, the first travelers whose goal was not Weset, the brand-new Pharaoh's city, might he live, thrive, and be healthy, where men and treasure streamed together, and where Menfe's weather-beaten name was good enough to be used for titles by Pharaoh's courtiers and head eunuchs. For instance, the head baker of the god, he who had oversight over the palace baking, was called Prince of Menfe, and perhaps with some justice. At least so much was true that at Menfe fine cakes in the shape of cows and snakes were carried round and sold when the Amun city was still content to bolt down roasted corn. The old man replied that, well, yes, they would probably go to Weset, after a considerable sojourn at Menfe, to cast an eye and see how far it had come on since then in the refinements of life and the development of bakestuffs. He was interrupted by a roll of drums. The rear gate opened, and the god was led into the court, only a few paces forward from the open doors. The excitement of the crowd was great. "Hoppy! Hoppy!" they shrieked, as they hopped on one leg, and, whom the crush permitted, threw himself on his face and kissed the earth. Many backs were so bent. The air was full of the throaty mewing of the sound with which the hundredfold utterance of the god's name began. It was likewise the name of the river, which had made the land and which preserved it. It was the name of the sun bull, the abstract of all the powers of fertility, on which these people knew themselves to depend, the name of the continued existence of land and folk, the name of life. They were deeply moved, light and garrulous though they might be, for their adoration was compact of all the hope and anxiousness with which narrowly conditioned existence fills the breast. They thought of the flood, which must not be an ell too high or too low if the land was to survive, of the industry of their wives and the health of their children, of their own body and its functions subject to reverses which gave them comfort and pleasure when all went well, but caused hard suffering when they gave out, and which must be safeguarded by magic against magic. They thought of the enemies of the land, south, east, and west, of Pharaoh, whom also they called the Strong Bull, and who they knew was cherished and preserved in the palace at Thebes, just as Hapi here, for that he protected them and formed in his transitory person the bridge between them and him on whom all depended. "Hapi! Hapi!" they cried in anxious jubilation, oppressed by the sense of their narrowly conditioned, precarious lives. Hopefully they stared at the square forehead of the beast god, the brazen horns, the compact neckline, without a curve from back to skull, at his sex organs, the pledge of fruitfulness. Security was what they meant by their cry. Protection and permanence. Up, Egypt!